Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. If energy from the sun could be converted to power, all of the world's fossil fuel and nuclear power plants could be closed. For now, though, solar power provides only a tiny fraction of the world's energy needs. In this hour, as part of our ongoing series on the environment, we'll talk about the solar industry and its prospects. Joining me in the studio, Roan Resch, President and Chief Executive Officer for the Solar Energy Industries Association, and Peter Fox Penner. He's a former Energy Department official who is now a consultant with the Brattle Group. And by phone from Livermore, California, Rob Lampkin, CEO of Cool Earth Solar. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for having us.
We also invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, Roan Resch, let's start by talking about where solar energy stands these days. We've been talking about the prospects for solar energy, it seems like, for years and years. Where do things stand now?
Well, Susan, I'll tell you, there's never been a better time for consumers to go solar than right now. Not only has the cost of solar, the solar panels, the price come down 30% in the last year, but we also have seen new state incentives, new federal incentives, and in most cases around the country, you can install solar on your home and business and have it paid for itself within 5 to 7 years.
So, Rob Lampkin, what proportion of the energy in the United States is now provided by solar energy?
I believe the latest numbers we've seen is something less than 1%.
And that seems very small to me. Does it seem small to you?
It's way too small. It needs to be much, much larger if we're going to address our very real energy problems that we have.
Well, I know that this is an issue, Peter Fox Penner, you've been working on for years, including at the Energy Department during the Clinton administration. Has solar power delivered in the way that advocates have envisioned it in the past?
Well, Susan, it has delivered in the sense that its costs have come down dramatically, as Roan mentioned, over the last 20 or 30 years, to the point where solar energy is now totally competitive with other forms of electricity supply in many applications. And over time, it will become even more competitive in more applications. As a result, Susan, all the forecasts show that with the good policy support, the percentage of energy we will be getting from solar will go up continuously and substantially over the next 30 years.
And what's the prospect over the next 30 years? At the end of 30 years, where could we be when it comes to solar energy?
Solar could easily, and from all of the solar technologies that Roan will talk about, we could easily be getting 10% of our electricity in 30 years from solar. And there's many other renewable forms of energy that are also becoming cost competitive, I'll just note.
So, Roan, talk about the different kinds of solar energy generation.
So there's really three primary sources of solar technology today. The first is photovoltaics, or PV panels, which directly convert sunlight to electricity. These tend to be the panels you see on homes or buildings around the United States. The second is solar thermal. This is the technology people traditionally think of from the 70s and early 80s. These panels are used to heat water for cooking, cleaning, showering, or industrial purposes. And the third is called concentrated solar, and this is a whole classification of different technologies that primarily are used for utility-scale power plants in the Southwest. These might be parabolic mirrors or Stirling dish engines or other technologies, but the idea there is that you're building very large power plants in order to generate electricity from the sun.
Now, a big boost for that last form of solar energy 2 weeks ago when the Interior Secretary, Ken Salazar, announced that the government was setting aside a huge amount of federal lands to look at them for possible solar projects. Tell us, Rob Lampkin, how important is this Interior Department announcement? How do you see it?
It is important. It doesn't apply so much to cooler solar because of our concentrating technology, but when you look at the size of the energy problem that we have, while rooftop solar is great, we really need to be thinking in terms of developing solar power plants on the hundreds and thousands of acres at a time in order to generate the massive amount of energy from clean solar energy that we really need to generate in this country to meet our needs and demand. So this look at this very large amount of land will go a long ways towards dealing with that energy problem. But for cooler solar, we probably won't be siting on much of that land. The benefit of our concentrating technology is we can site in much closer to the existing loads. So we kind of fit a niche that's halfway between those very large concentrating solar plants out in the middle of the desert and the solar panels that are on the rooftops. We're kind of in the middle, closer into load. Projects are more in 100 acres of size and at more land closer into cities.
Well, Peter, talk to us about this announcement that the Interior Department made. Now, Salazar talked about getting 13 solar power plants online under construction by the end of next year.
Well, that's an ambitious goal. But you do raise an important point, Susan. For large-scale solar plants, there's two critical needs. One of them is siting permission, and often that's needed on federal lands. A second critical need for these plants is transmission lines built right up to the edge of the plant. And building transmission is probably the single biggest, if not one of the two biggest issues confronting the solar industry, both at the high voltage scale where you see the big lines going across the land, and also locally where you need to hook up to the local distribution system at much lower voltages, but you still need the right policies and interconnection standards.
And Susan, if I could jump in, the announcement by the Department of Interior last week was critical, in large part because there are over 200 applications to the Department of Interior for solar projects on BLM lands. This alone represents enough electricity to generate about 35% of all the power needs of the United States just on those projects right now. But unfortunately, even though a lot of these applications have been in for 3 or 4 years, not one has been processed. And so what Secretary Salazar has pledged to do is to develop environmental assessments and records of decision on 24 different study areas. They want to understand the environmental impact of the technology. They want to understand the environmental sensitivities of those areas in an effort to make sure there's a balance between environmental protection and then clean energy generation. And so it's hopeful that many of these areas, if they are proved to be not sensitive ecosystems or not sensitive lands, that they will then go ahead as solar development zones. And we will see, as you were just describing, at least a dozen projects under construction next year.
Now, the BLM would be the Bureau of Land Management.
That's correct.
Now, why has the Bureau of Land Management not approved any of these 200 applications?
Well, in large part, the BLM lands were primarily used from an energy perspective for oil and gas drilling. And so when you went out to their regional offices, they had plenty of staff to process permits to drill, PODs, but they did not have anybody with the technological background or the understanding of solar energy projects. And so they've had to staff up, and certainly Secretary Salazar has made a great effort in increasing, and the stimulus dollars have made a great effort in increasing staffing at these offices to process these permits.
What is the role of the stimulus spending in terms of solar energy?
It's absolutely critical.
I mean, what is it being used for?
A wide variety of different things. So certainly on large-scale solar, it's developed to try to move process permits forward so these projects can go under construction within a short period of time frame. But also there's about $3.2 billion that's going out to the states to help provide new incentives for homeowners and small businesses to go solar. So states that have never had incentives before, like Virginia, for example, now will be offering a rebate that's worth about 25% of the cost of a solar system. So we're seeing the stimulus dollars be used to create jobs for electricians and plumbers and roofers installing solar around the United States.
Now, Peter, you talked about the issue, another big issue being these transmission lines. The Bush administration, in really its final months in office, laid out a plan for 6,000 miles of these transmission lines in corridors in Western states, but there are some concerned advocates of solar energy. Why?
Well, there's lots of concerns over transmission expansion plans, Susan. As you know, they're often unpopular with localities that the lines go through and with governors. I think there's also a concern about the federal government dictating where the lines will go. We are working through a new transmission policy discussion right now. There are several proposals on Capitol Hill and lots of discussions in the states. And I do think the country needs and hopefully will get a reform in its transmission siting policies.
Rob Lampkin, when you think about, from your perspective, of what the big challenges are for expanding the use of solar energy, what do you see them?
We've been very encouraged with the new RFPs, the renewable energy standards, the RPS standards that the different states, many states, have been putting forth and adopting. We very much would like to see, since we're on the large solar power plant side of the business, not the rooftop solar, but the large power plants that are out in the fields, a national RPS standard would be wonderful and would be a great accelerator to deploying more solar, and probably better yet, a feed-in tariff. That would be state by state or nationwide would also be even a better accelerator.
What is a feed-in tariff?
A feed-in tariff was put in place, I think, very successfully in Germany. And the feed-in tariff is basically a contract that's put out there by the utilities that's available right up front, that any power producer can step in, execute that contract, build their power plants, and start selling the electricity directly to the utilities. So you hear a lot about an RPS, which states that the utilities must serve a certain percentage of their loads from renewable electric sources.
Mm-hmm.
A feed-in tariff is the same thing, but it's a quicker path, and it's an accelerator to meet those standards quicker.
All right. Well, we're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we'll go to the phones. Our phone lines are filling up, 1-800-433-8850, and we'll read some emails, drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and we're talking this hour about the promise and problems of solar energy. And before we go to the phones, let's talk about the climate change bill that's passed the House. It's now going to go to the Senate. Would that affect this issue of solar energy?
Oh, yes, without question. In my book, I take a look at some of the scenarios for complying with climate change legislation, and there's no question that a carbon cap and a price on carbon makes solar substantially more competitive, and it will increase its penetration over time.
You know, I think what it also does, Susan, is it sends a very clear signal to consumers that you should be doing something as a homeowner to reduce your carbon footprint. Not only is it important for you to be an energy patriot, but you should also be doing what you can to reduce the amount of emissions that your home or your cars is producing. And solar is got the best carbon return of any technology out there, meaning it requires some energy to produce. But this product comes warranted for performance for 25 years. So you're going to be producing carbon-free energy for a minimum of 25 years and really help consumers lower their carbon emissions.
Let's talk for a few minutes now with Alex Dowie. He's the Renewable Energy Coordinator with the Wilderness Society, and he's joining us by phone from his office in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Now, we talked about the announcement by the Interior Secretary 2 weeks ago about setting aside large group of tracts of federal lands to study for siting big solar energy power plants. What do you think about that?
Well, at the Wilderness Society, we do support responsible development of renewable energy to address our climate and energy needs. And we feel that guiding development to lands that have high potential and low environmental conflicts is definitely the right approach.
Now, are you concerned that there may be solar energy power plants located on places that are delicate environmentally?
Certainly. Just like any industrial use of lands for energy production, there are serious impacts from solar developments. And for those reasons, we need to be aggressively pursuing conservation of energy, energy efficiency, distributed generation, along with large-scale renewable developments. And where those developments go is extremely important. So we're working with our conservation partners and the agencies to try and identify those places and guide development away from sensitive places that are not appropriate for energy development.
Well, what would happen if a lot of the land, in fact, more than half the land they're looking at is on the Mojave Desert in California? What would be the consequences of putting a solar plant in a place that was sensitive environmentally?
There can be a number of consequences. There are threatened and endangered species that can be impacted. There are cultural resources, concerns about water use, recreational opportunities. But again, we see a real opportunity here to use the incredible power of this sun across the landscape to find the right places for developments, guide it there, and avoid impacts to these places that are not appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And explain the difference. There's a lot of talk about putting these on disturbed land rather than wilderness. What's the difference between those two sorts of places?
Well, wildlands or wilderness are areas that are undisturbed from roads, energy and housing developments, other human impacts like uncultivated forests and deserts and grasslands. And these are places with, you know, intact wildlife habitat, clean air and water, places people enjoy hiking, hunting and fishing, connecting with nature. And that's opposed to areas that may have been farmed intensively or developed for oil and gas drilling already, places that have seen impacts and would be more appropriate for this type of energy development.
And do you have any concerns that the Obama administration is not going to pay enough attention to these questions, these issues involving where to site the plants?
Well, we're focused on ensuring that as we transition to renewables, the government is careful with our public lands and takes a hard look at what makes the most sense. There's real opportunity on private, state, and public lands to make sure this goes in the right places, and we're working hard to work with the administration, the agencies, industry, conservation partners, and the public to make sure that renewables is a win for both climate and the land.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
That was Alex Dowie. He's Renewable Energy Coordinator with the Wilderness Society. Well, you know, we have an emailer who expresses some concern about the amount of water that's necessary with a solar project. Here's what he writes. This is from Suzanne. She writes, I am writing from Kingman, located in northwestern Arizona. Two large concentrated solar projects, one 200 megawatts and the other 340 megawatts, are proposed to be built nearby. The community's main concern is the amount of water, several million gallons a day, that these plants will use in a desert area. Please ask your guest if there is a better solar technology out there. Well, let me ask you, Rob Lamkin, is this of concern, the water use of solar plants?
It has been raised as a concern, and most of the concentrating solar technologies require quite a bit of water in their process in order to make their clean solar energy. We've noticed this issue and taken it very much to heart, and our technology has a closed-loop cooling system, which means that we use very, very little water. We don't use the massive amounts of water that many of the concentrating solar technologies require.
All right. Roan Resch.
I think it's important to point out that this is not just about solar. Mm-hmm. It's any power plant uses a huge amount of water, nuclear power plants, coal power plants, et cetera. And in this case, what solar does is it creates high temperature oil that then creates steam and runs the standard power block. There are water recapturing technologies available where you can reuse the water and you can keep it almost in a closed loop system, which substantially reduces the amount of water used in this area. So as we go forward, I think the innovations that you're going to see not only in renewables, but also more efficient use of water. And then the other technology to point out is photovoltaics. PV panels use no water. These are panels that literally sit in the sun and generate electricity consistently over a long period of time with no maintenance, no water, again, very little impact. And so there's a lot of different technologies technology options available depending upon the environmental resources and the environmental sensitivities of that area.
So the answer to Suzanne might be yes, there could be maybe a better technology to use that would take advantage of the power of the sun without using quite so much water.
Certainly, there are technologies that improve the amount of water use for traditional CSP plants, but then other concentrating solar products that are available that use substantially less water, yes.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to James. He's calling us from Baltimore. James, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. Hi, Ms. Page. How are you?
Good.
I had a question concerning, well, first of all, I'm a 34-year-old general contractor in Baltimore for the past 2 years. I've been in the roofing and siding industry for the past 12 years. I remember when I was 10 years old watching the photovoltaic cars on Maryland Public Television go down the streets and have these races. The technology has been around forever. Why hasn't there been more of an incentive by the government standpoint to help promote more efficient solar panels? And also, why not tap into, right here in Baltimore, the rooftops of all these homes, more of an incentive by the government, government-funded programs to help promote the usage of all these rooftops, which will be perfect for photovoltaic cells, and the grid doesn't have to be changed. No land, no water, just using what we already have in existence to help promote. I mean, we're talking about a vast, vast energy potential that we have not tapped into, and I'm wondering why.
Oh, James, great question. Before we let you go, you're a general contractor. How often do people who are hiring you to build a house or work on their house, how often do they express interest or curiosity about trying to use some alternative energy sources like solar?
Well, I'll tell you, a lot more than used to. I would go back maybe 5 years, there was almost none. Within the last 5 years, I do a lot of work on Maryland's Eastern Shore, a lot of private, well-to-do people on the Eastern Shore, and they're not concerned about the energy prospect. They're more concerned about being more conservative with the electrical production and just having another option. So they are more interested in it, and they're willing to pay the price, and that's just the incentive they have right now is just phenomenal. But we're talking 3 years ago, there was a panel produced by a company, I don't know the name, whose panels are 10 times more energy productive than 5 years ago. So I think that's phenomenal, but I think it could be better. I mean, we're talking old technology. We're not talking about anything new. We're talking about technology that just has to be tapped into and developed.
All right, James. Thanks so much for your call. Roan.
Just to answer James's first part of his question, which is an important one, and you actually hit on it earlier, Susan, which is what happened to solar and why hasn't the government supported solar? Well, in 1983, the Reagan administration allowed incentives for solar energy tax credits to expire. And it was 24 years, James, since that point before new incentives were put in place. Finally, in the 2005 energy bill, an entire generation later, these were the first tax credits for homeowners to put solar on their homes. So during that time period, there was a lot of support for nukes and coal and natural gas and other technologies, but other than R&D, very minimal out of the federal government. But the great news is, out of the 2005 energy bill, we created a 30% tax credit. In the bailout bill in October, that tax credit was extended and expanded for 8 additional years. So as I pointed out before, there's never been a better time to go solar. And James, I got a feeling you're going to get a lot more people asking about solar energy in their next projects, because Maryland has one of the most aggressive renewable portfolio standards in the country. And over the next 10 years, Maryland is going to install about half as much solar as the entire state of California is over the same time period. So it is going to be a major economic driver in the state of Maryland.
You know, we have an emailer, Daniel, who says, given a suburb with only average amounts of sunlight, can solar panels make back their costs over the life of the panel? And I'm wondering, Maryland is not one of the nation's sunniest states. It's not like one of the Western states. Does it make a difference? Are there places where this would be a good idea and places where perhaps it wouldn't work?
Well, the great thing about the United States is we have the best solar resources of any developed country in the world. Germany, which Rob pointed out is the leader, they install about 6 times as much solar as the United States does each year. Germany has the solar insolation equivalent of Anchorage, Alaska. And so if Germany can make solar work well, we can make solar work extremely well in all 50 states. And just to give you an example, in Baltimore and Maryland or even in New England, you're getting 50 to 60% more sunlight than Germany does. So it, we do have spectacular resources, and solar can work in all 50 states.
Now, we have a caller who worked in Germany for a solar company. His name is Tom, and he's calling us from Chestertown, Maryland. Tom, thanks for being with us. What was your experience there?
I worked for a company in central Germany from July to March, and we built a 1.2 megawatt solar farm with fully tracking solar trees, did an awful lot of personal home installations as well. And I wanted to have your guests perhaps comment on the feed-in tariffs, and correct me if my understanding of what was going on there. They have the Germans have the same upfront cost subsidies that come from the government that is here, the 30%, and then state to state it varies as to how much money you can get back on the upfront cost. But you get locked in guaranteed prices per kilowatt hour for the power that you generate, and those for 20 years you get that price. And those inflated prices are paid for by ratepayers. And so all the ratepayers pay an elevated price. And to me, that's a great way to go. It's not a government subsidy per se. And perhaps Europeans in general, Germans in particular, are more they are used to having they're used to being taxed. They're used to being having these sorts of subsidies, for lack of a better word, forced on them. Mm-hmm. They're not disgruntled about it. They understand that they're supporting the solar industry, but it has led Germany, which is by our standards, a relatively small country, and they're the largest purchaser of solar panels in the world.
Isn't that interesting? Peter Foxpinner, what about the points that Tom was making?
Well, I think Tom's facts are largely correct. And the issue with feed-in tariffs, as Roan, I think, has mentioned, is that they're expensive. You guarantee a price for solar power, usually at or above the current price of power, for 20 years. And that puts the customers on the hook for a lot of money. And as a result, it's unpopular here in the United States.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Jonathan, who's calling us from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
I was calling to talk about, or at least get your guys' comments on the subsidies for fossil fuels and nuclear versus renewable energy resources.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call, Roan.
I think it's important for everybody to understand that our country has always provided subsidies for energy, literally from the very beginning, either tax credits or loan guarantees or insurance guarantees for literally all other technologies. It's literally been renewables, frankly, that Congress and the administration has had waning support for. When our tax credit was created in 2005, it was only created for 2 years. You can't build an industry on a two-year tax credit. So thankfully, they've now extended it for 8 additional years. But let's be realistic. The oil industry enjoys permanent tax credits and incentives. The nuclear industry is heavily subsidized, and all of those incentives are permanent. So I think what's important, and Jonathan's point's a good one, which is if we want to see renewable energy a major part of not only our energy mix, but our economy, and creating all those green-collar jobs that we talk so much about, we need to make sure we have a level playing field and that the same kinds of incentives and the same scale of incentives are provided for renewables that are currently provided for the coal, nuclear, and oil and gas industries.
I think Roan is correct in that there have been incentives, and they've been a part of every energy technology, every form of energy, and that renewables have been disadvantaged historically. I think we're taking a whole fresh look at energy policy in the United States today. I think the biggest thing to come along in our lifetimes will be climate change legislation, which puts a price on carbon and will really change the direction of our energy development And you may call it a subsidy. I wouldn't. I would call it pricing an externality that needs to be done. But you will have the government influencing price in a very, very big way there.
And what are the Obama administration's goals? What goals have they set out when it comes to renewable energy?
Well, the president's, I think, set out a doubling of renewable energy as a percentage in the first 10 years of his, or the next 10 years, rather. And he's also set out as a very important goal passing climate change legislation. And as I noted, Susan, that's really going to set the direction for energy policy in the next decades.
Right. I think one of the things that the Obama administration has recognized is the fact that we create jobs. And these are the kinds of jobs we need to have in this country. So not only reinventing our energy policy in the near term, but also creating the jobs, the manufacturing jobs, and the new business models that are so critical to right our economy.
We're going
to
take another very short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about what's happening with solar power. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In warm lagoons off the coast of Baja California, giant gray whales are approaching boats and playfully interacting with humans. The 30-ton creatures are making eye contact and letting people pet them. On the next Fresh Air, marine mammal behaviorist Tony Frohoff and writer Charles Siebert tell us what this trusting relationship reveals about the nature of whales. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and we'd like to welcome WKMS in Western Kentucky to our growing list of affiliates. Thanks for becoming part of the Diane Rehm Show family, and we look forward to hearing your questions and comments. In this hour, we're talking about solar power, and we have an emailer, Scott, who says, "With all due respect, solar power has always been the once-in-future electric power source. The main detriment has been the cost involved and the payback for homeowner business solar investments. If utilities invest in solar for wide use, they still have to build or maintain backup power plants to provide power when there's not adequate sun, which costs a lot of money. Therefore, the cost to consumers is much greater than just producing solar power. What does your panel say? Peter, what do you think?
Well, Scott's making some accurate points. Solar doesn't generate 24 hours a day, and there does need to be a backup system behind it. The power industry is well aware of this, and when computing the economics of solar facilities, whether it's on a rooftop or in a large-scale plant, the industry kind of factors all of this in. As we do that, we are finding that solar is becoming economic in a lot of applications. And so that while Scott does make a point about backup power needing to be there, when solar is put in the right place with the right backup, it's part of a low-cost energy future. And over time, that's going to increase.
And Rob Lampkin, what would you say to Scott's question?
I agree with just the comment answer that was just given. I would emphasize that every source of power, every energy source requires a backup, whether it's coal, hydro, natural gas fired. When you look at a system, a whole electric grid, an electric system, the power plants are backing each other up. And I don't think it's fair or accurate to characterize solar as requiring more of a backup than a hydro plant or a coal plant or some other facility. Solar's an important role, and it does need some backup when the sun's not shining, but so do other power plants. And when coal is short, to natural gas is short, oil is short, those projects need backups too. So I think solar is ready for a bright future, and I don't think a backup is the problem.
Peter, you're shaking your head.
Well, I beg to differ a little bit with Rob. It is absolutely true that all power plants need backup, and that's to a large extent what the grid does. And the power plants in this country and every other system do back each other up. Certain forms of solar are available a smaller percentage of the time than a typical plant, so they do need more capital invested for backup, and that does need to be factored into the economics. I don't think it's the equivalent amounts of backup, but at the same time, when you do it right, solar's a part of the mix, and that will increase.
Susan, it's important that we don't think of electricity across a 24-hour day as all being equal. We as consumers use about four times as much electricity during the day than we do at night. The reason why is you're home asleep, your computers are off, you know, your lights are off, et cetera. But when you wake up in the morning, you turn on your air conditioner, you turn on your lights and computers, and we're using more. That's called peak demand. And the beautiful thing about solar is it generates electricity at the point in which demand is greatest, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day. And so when you look at the cost of electricity to the consumer, the peak electricity is the most expensive. If you can create a structure in which a price signal is sent to the consumer, as they have in California, it's called real-time pricing, then what you see is that solar is cost competitive, that it is the lowest cost option for reducing electricity costs of peak power to the consumer.
Because it's most available
when demand is
highest. Yeah. Right. Let's talk to Robert. He's calling us from Palm Beach, Florida, a pretty sunny place. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
I would just like to share with everyone the fact that we installed a PV system on our home, 4.4 kilowatts, about 2 years ago, and it has really been a really great system. We've got a grid tie system with a battery backup, and sometimes when the power goes out in our neighborhood, we don't even know it. And as you know, we have lots of storms down here, thunderstorms and so forth, and it has just made life a lot easier for us. And I'd also like to comment that your panel is right on, because the peak generation occurs, of course, in the middle of the day when we need our air conditioning and our lighting and computers and everything are running at their hardest. And that's when our PV system is working hardest. And that has just been fantastic, and it's actually altered our lifestyle. My wife will say, oh, I'm going to wait a little bit to dry the clothes because I've got to wait for the sun to come up. And we've changed our habits so that we follow the sun. And one other thing I'd like to say is that this is a clean system. We don't have to worry about whether the oil has been changed in our generator. It always works. And it's just been a really good thing for us. And we believe very strongly in the future being a distributed generation. And that way, if one small portion of the grid goes out, then we're not impacted as seriously as we would be if a huge power plant goes out.
Now, does your solar unit generate all the electricity you use in your house or only part of it?
That's been a kind of an interesting thing, too. We have generated about 40% of our energy over the 2 years, and we've learned that it's really important to do conservation and add insulation. We've changed all the light bulbs out to compact fluorescent. We used to run our computers 24 hours a day, and now we shut them off. And we've started turning things off, and we probably should have done that first. And I would recommend that everyone do that first, because adding insulation to your attic is much more cost-effective than adding a photovoltaic system, as we did. But we had to change our roof, add a new roof, because our roof was 40 years old. And as you know, you don't always do things in the most logical order. So when we had that opportunity to put a new roof on, that's when we said we should do our photovoltaic system.
Interesting, Robert. Thanks so much for calling and sharing your experiences.
One of the things that Robert points out, which I think is key, is he did it 2 years ago, and things have changed dramatically, even in those last 2 years. And you have new state incentives. You have a new federal tax credit, which is a 30% tax credit. It's never been cheaper to go solar. And if you go to our website, which is seia.org, so www.seia.org, you'll get a link to all of the incentives that are available at every state, every utility level, and then also the federal tax credits. And you'll see that in many cases, you can reduce the upfront cost of solar by 50% or more.
And SEIA stands for Solar Energy Industries Association.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Susan, I'm so glad that Robert mentioned energy efficiency along with doing renewable energy and solar power. I think Robert is one of the wisest energy consumers I have heard in many, many years, because he's learned that a good energy policy, it begins with energy efficiency, that is usually the most cost-effective way you can reduce your electricity demand, and you begin with that, whether through home insulation and changing your light bulbs, lots of other things, and you move on to renewable energy, excuse me, and other forms of power. That's what I think we need as an energy policy in the United States, and I think it is the direction the Obama administration and Congress are moving.
Now, Arthur from Athens, Ohio, sends us an email. What are the opposition forces to solar power? Is there visible lobbying from, say, West Virginia's coal industry? Well, Rob Lampkin, where do you see the opposition to solar energy?
In the solar space that we're in, doing large utility-scale power plants out in the western United States on land which has already been disturbed, farmland, fallow farmland, cattle grazing land that's not been used for years and years, frankly, we don't see much opposition. We find the utilities very, very friendly and willing to buy all the solar energy we can produce. Since we're going on land that's already been disturbed, the gentleman earlier that spoke from the wilderness group, we don't trigger all those negative environmental impacts, whatever those may be, because we're going on disturbed, pre-disturbed land. So what's great about, what's good, lucky for us at Cooler Solar is we're not seeing the opposition either on the environmental front. And then given the cost of our equipment, we're able to sell our power at prices that utilities like, and that's been a real plus for us.
Well, how about in Washington? Is there organized opposition to some of the incentives, for instance, that you've talked about for solar power?
That's a good point. That's very correct, Susan. As we advocate for a national RPS and, better yet, a national feed-in tariff, there is definitely opposition against that. And but we think we're on the side side of right, the side that's eventually going to win out. And so we're very hopeful that we'll get that at some point.
What about, Roan, what about other kinds of energy producers? Do they oppose some of the incentives that solar energy has been getting?
Not historically. The coal industry doesn't oppose this. The nuke industry doesn't oppose it. I think what you tend to find is everybody recognizes you need an energy mix going forward. But what we're fighting for, in large part, for solar energy is a level playing field. And we don't have that right now. We don't have access to the electricity marketplace. We don't have what are called standardized interconnection standards in this country, meaning simply if you design a solar system to be installed in Chicago, Illinois, you can't take that same solar system and install it in Cleveland, Ohio. You have to go through a whole different set of interconnection standards in the two different states. We also don't have national retail net metering, meaning you can't sell your electricity back into the grid in a lot of states in this country. So until we have literally just market access rules that allow solar to access the marketplace, it's going to be difficult for us to be cost competitive in the long run. And that's a very important provision that we're trying to get passed in this energy bill.
Let's go to Statesville, North Carolina, and talk to Karen. Karen, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Susan, and thank your guests for this program today. I have had a similar to your caller, former caller in Florida, who was very happy with his system. We have a PV system here that we've had for 2 years, and I'm very happy with the system. But our support from the local energy company, Duke Energy, has just been dire. We had the system installed in 2007 in March, and we called them repeatedly for inspections, and they would come out and inspect, but they refused to interconnect us. And we finally figured out by talking to just an amazing number of people this because we hadn't filled out some paperwork that they required, but we weren't informed of that. So this kind of thing has gone on for the whole our whole tenure in the with the PV system. And so my concern is that even though Duke Energy wants to do a program called the Million Solar Rooftops, that they're really not prepared. They don't have systems in place in terms of bureaucracy or the necessary paperwork or informing the consumers about what it would take for the consumers to move through the process smoothly. Our electrical contractor who has a master's degree in electrical engineering and worked in the military nuclear sub said he's actually never run into a company that's been so difficult to work with. And provides energy for Charlotte, North Carolina, so it's not like it's a small-time company. It's a very large company, but for some reason, they just aren't really on board with this amount, this kind of program.
Well, let me ask, Ron, is this a common experience that people have?
Absolutely. I installed a system in my home here and ran into the same challenges here in D.C., but especially in those states that aren't deregulated, like North Carolina, you're going to face a very big challenge.
So what should Karen do?
Well, I think what is happening, slowly but surely, is that utilities are starting to recognize that there's a new business model there for them, that they can own and operate the solar system on their house and that sell the electricity to the homeowner, that it doesn't have to be owned by somebody else, and they're not going to lose a rate payer, if you will.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, we've seen some big companies get interested in solar power. Walmart, for instance, is moving to install more solar powers on solar units on its big, those giant flat rooftops that you see on Walmart stores. How important is that, do you think, Peter?
Oh, I think it's extremely important if large commercial customers see the benefits of installing solar and also daylighting and also energy efficiency technologies, which Walmart is also a leader in. But I wonder, Susan, if I could go back to Karen's point about her difficulties. I'm certainly sorry that she faced those difficulties. Sorry Roan faced them on his house. But I mentioned my book. One of the reasons I wrote it is that at Brattle Group, we work with utilities all around the world. And utilities are confronting a change to their culture and their technology and their mission that is unprecedented in their history. They are changing from cultures that only knew how to build coal plants and large-scale projects to organizations that have to help customers install energy efficiency, help them connect up solar panels on their homes, help them do all sorts of things that are new to them, put in this thing we're calling the smart grid, which is a dramatic change in how they manage their systems, help them cope with climate change, which is new. And those are cultural changes, they're organizational changes, and utilities really do are grappling with a need to build up new capabilities and new staffs. At the same time, Susan, the regulatory system that we have in place for utilities is antiquated. And you have to sympathize a little with utilities because they are not incentivized now to help Karen hook up her solar panels, and we really need to change that. And that's a big mission I'm on.
Peter Fox Pinner, he's a principal and chairman emeritus with the Brattle Group, an international consulting firm, and he has a book coming out in February called Smart Power. And we've also been joined this hour in the studio by Ron Resch. He's president and chief executive officer of the Solar Energy Industries Association. That's a website you can go to if you want more information about setting up solar energy panels on your own home. And in California, joined by phone with Rob Lampkin, CEO of Cool Earth Solar. Thank you all for being with us for this hour of the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.